Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Have you heard of Up First, the morning news podcast from NPR? Give it 10 minutes or so, and you'll hear about the news and big ideas you need to get through the day. Wake up with Up First tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Eastern Time on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Fernanda Echavarri, in for Maria Hinojosa.
Hi. Nada más déjame avisarle a Flavio que no vuelve en la noche al dominó.
No.
Vámonos.
Do you recognize that voice?
¿Qué no la puedes hacer un poco menos rápido, menos...
If you do, you get some extra Mexi points. If you don't, this is the voice of Eugenio Derbez. He's one of, if not the most famous Mexican comedian of the last 30 years. He's an actor, writer, director, and producer. He's been at the forefront of many comedy series, and the reruns, even from his work in the early 90s, are on TV in Mexico all the time. Eugenio Derbez is also a pretty well-known name in the rest of Latin America and in Spanish-speaking households here in the U.S. His stuff is super over the top. He's played a hunchback monk who tells scary stories, a goalie superhero who wears a net as his cape, and the dad in a family that dresses only in neon plush furry outfits. And he's also the voice of Donkey in the Latin American version of the Shrek movies, for which he wrote his own jokes.
Así es, tonto. Ahora soy un burro que habla y vuela. ¿Han visto cómo su dinero vuela? Pero a que nunca...
In 2013, he had his first film play in U.S. theaters, instructions not included, which turned out to be the highest-grossing Spanish-language movie here ever.
¿Es todo lo que tienes que decir? O sea, te largas 6 años y te apareces solo para decir que está bonita.
And now he'll be acting in English for the first time in his new film, How to Be a Latin Lover, where he stars alongside Salma Hayek and Rob Lowe.
I mean, it's not just for, it's, I know it sounds like it's going to be something.
I mean, the word lover is in it, so.
Exactly. So it's like, it could be not for my kids, but it's PG-13. So you can bring your kids, you can bring your abuelitas, your tíos, your everyone, el perro, el perico, everyone.
Eugenio's superstardom in Mexico did not translate into the U.S. He had to start over as a newbie in Hollywood, and it wasn't easy. On today's show, we'll hear from people who find themselves in situations they never thought they would be in, like the insurance rep who went from denying people health coverage to fighting for his mom to get medical care. We'll hear the story of Jews and Nazis from Latin America who ended up in a detention camp together in the U.S. during World War II. And we go to a neighborhood in Rio that never thought it would be a household name around the world. But first, let's get back to Mexican comedian Eugenio Derbez. I recently sat down with him to talk about his new movie, How to Be a Latin Lover.
You've been on Mexican television and Spanish-speaking TV all over the world, really, always acting in Spanish. So what was the hardest part about doing a whole movie in English?
I feel like I'm another person. But I like it because it's challenging. At the beginning, I was like afraid of acting in English because I thought I was going to lose my comedy, my style. So I had to reinvent myself a little bit because in Spanish, for example, I play a lot with words, mm-hmm. a lot. And here in English, I can't do that because I don't know the language that well. If you watch any comedy show in Mexico, Latin America, we're big. Everything, all the reactions are huge, big. We yell at each other. So it's huge. And here in the U.S., everything is contained, grounded. But at the same time, I think we found a great balance between the American sense of humor and the Hispanic, Latino, or my own sense of humor.
Do you think you're as funny in English as you are in Spanish?
I hope so. I feel like I'm different. I'm funny, but in a different way. And I like that because it's like if I was born again. I'm taking a lot of classes. I'm still learning English, learning. I have an accent reduction coach.
Wow.
Yes, because before that, I was speaking more like this. And then you try to get rid of the accent and start pronouncing better.
It's enchanting to meet you.
Maximo.
Maximo.
The lady and I will have your finest champagne, something as refreshing and exciting as she is.
And we at our show are no strangers to some Latino stereotypes. like, for example, The Latin Lover. Talk to us a little bit about sort of embracing that stereotype and in a way kind of making fun of it.
I was aware that it was like a very strong stereotype here in the U.S. Because every time I was wearing a suit or a tuxedo or something nice, all the Anglos, they were immediately like, oh, The Latin Lover. Oh, you look like a Latin lover. So it was funny to me. And I think that the best way to break down a stereotype is to poke fun at it. So I decided to make fun of the stereotype, to make people understand that it's just that, a stereotype.
I want to talk about your fame, because I doubt that you can walk down the street.
Well, yeah, they
You're
know me.
You're that famous.
Yeah, they know me pretty well. I probably, yes. It's hard to kind of walk to any place in Mexico. Yeah, they would ask for autographs and that. But what I like about L.A. is that I'm able to walk. I mean, there are a lot of Latinos also here, but it's not the same. So I'm still an unknown or a new face, and that's what I like about Los Angeles or New York. I still can walk on the streets, and I feel more freedom.
Which is insane to me, because you are probably the most famous face. You think comedy in Mexico, and you think Eugenio Derbez immediately.
Yeah.
So the idea that you're here, and you're kind of starting fresh and are a little bit more unknown, what's that like for your work? Showing up to make a movie or presenting a script to someone and say, I'm kind of a big deal in Mexico and in Latin America.
Well, when I came here for first time a few years ago, it was really hard for me to sell myself. They didn't believe me. I was like, I swear that I have a big audience in Mexico and Latin America. So if you include me in a feature film, they are going to come watch me. So you're going to have more, you're going to sell more tickets, whatever. I was trying to sell myself and nobody believed me. You haven't done anything here in the U.S., you're nobody. And at the end, I hired myself. What I did with this movie is that I create this project. I did my own project. I developed the script and I produced the film. And that's why I'm here, because that's the only way, when you give yourself the chance, because if not, nobody does. And on the other hand, when it was risky, because I had my own production company, my office, a big production that have worked with me for 20 years, everything. And I closed my life, every single thing. And I came to the U.S. to
Why?
Start over again. Because, I don't know, because I'm crazy, because I like to take challenges.
And go to a place where you can kind of hit a reset or a
yes.
Start from a different place.
But you
maybe.
Know what? It's refreshing. I feel that if I stay here doing the same thing, just my shows, one after another, after another, after another, I felt I was dying inside of me. And I felt that coming here was going to be refreshing. I can't tell you why. It was just something in my stomach, in my guts. I'm every single day trying to demonstrate who I am, like when I was 15, 16, again, so I feel refreshed.
Have you watched a show called Jane the Virgin?
Yes.
Okay. So Jane the Virgin has like the abuelita que habla español with the granddaughter who speaks English, and they communicate that way. You did a little bit of it in Instructions Not Included.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of that in How to Be a Latin Lover. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on sort of the code switching between languages like that in mainstream in Hollywood.
Actually, when I was when we were shooting, I told the director, you know, when Salma and I are by ourselves in the room, we should speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we do. We both are Mexicans in real life and in the story. So usually when we're born in Mexico and you're with another Mexican, you speak Spanish. And when you're with other people, you speak English. So we decided to reflect how life is and how reality is.
Ah, que estás verdaderamente perdido de la cabeza.
¿Qué eres, mi hermana?
No, pues sí, ahora sí soy tu hermana, ¿verdad?
Siempre ha sido mi hermana.
Did you ever think that you would end up sort of crossing over into Hollywood and mainstream? Was that a goal of yours, or did it just sort of happen when you decided to give yourself that challenge?
I mean, when I was a kid, when I was 8, 10, I was every single year watching the Oscars with my mom by her side. I told her when I was a kid, I want to do that. When I grow up, I want to tell stories. I want to make movies. And I was dreaming about Hollywood when I was young, really young. And then I forgot my dream. And, you know, life takes you for different paths. And I became a dad, and then my career started succeeding a little bit more in Mexico. So I forgot about my dream. And when I was 40 and my mom died, we were talking before she died about my dreams that I had when I was a kid. So I'm sure that the minute she died, she started helping me from there. Because 2 months later, I received a call from Hollywood, from an agent, a manager. And the adventure began, and here I am. I never, ever, ever expected to be here in Hollywood, in less right now, and at my age. Never, ever.
You are settled in L.A. You just wrapped up this project. What's next?
My next movie, the next one I'm shooting, is the remake of a very well-known movie from the 80s. Called Overboard.
Somebody call for a carpenter?
That's my wife's department.
So we're doing the remake of that movie with Anna Faris and I. And we switched the roles. So I'm playing Goldie Hawn's character and she's playing Kurt Russell's. The natural thing to think is, okay, Anna Faris is going to play the millionaire and the yacht, and Kurt Russell, he was playing a carpenter. So the natural thing is that I'm going to play... the Mexican is going to play the carpenter. So I said, no, let's switch roles.
So not only are you crossing over into the U.S. market, you're going for like a classic and then turning it on its head. Like, welcome to the U.S.
I know. It is.
Thanks to Eugenio Derbez, How to Be a Latin Lover is out in theaters now. Coming up on Latino USA, a mostly forgotten episode from World War II of a Louisiana internment camp.
Camp commanders started writing to Washington saying, I thought we were going to be housing and guarding dangerous Nazis, and you're sending us whole families and old men and Spanish speakers and children, and we don't understand.
Stay with us, no te vayas.
Latino USA are committed to bringing you honest and critical journalism from diverse perspectives. As part of a nonprofit media group, our goal is to equip you with the best information for navigating our changing world. Please support our mission today. Donate at latinousa.org. Make your gift more impactful and consider supporting us with a monthly gift. We love hearing from our listeners, like Randy Inegas, who posted to Facebook, I have learned so much about my people, culture, history, politics, and economic experiences. Latino USA made a big difference in my life. Thank you, Randy. If you feel the same way, please donate today at latinousa.org. Every penny helps our award-winning journalism.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the United States Postal Service, providing shipping for small, medium, and big businesses, and delivering online purchases to homes across the country. More information is at usps.com/tunegocio. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing justice and opportunity for people in need. More information at publicwelfare.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Fernanda Echavarri, in for Maria Hinojosa. When we talk about internment camps and World War II in the same sentence, what usually follows is a story about Japanese Americans. But what if I told you there were other internment camps right here on U.S. soil, and that they were for people from Latin America?
On December 7th, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards.
It all started with Pearl Harbor.
To our Navy was the loss of war vessels, airplanes, and equipment. But more costly to Japan was the effectiveness of its foul attack in immediately unifying America in its determination to fight and win the war thrust upon it, and to win the peace that will follow.
After that attack, the United States became increasingly concerned that in addition to Axis powers in Western Europe and Japan, there might be a third front to look out for, Latin America. At the time, more than 1.5 million Germans lived in Latin America, so the U.S. government sent FBI agents there to find potential German Nazis and bring them to the U.S. for internment. The problem was, of the nearly 5,000 people rounded up, many, if not most, were innocent, and some were Jewish. They were sent to a place that was called Camp Algiers. From WWNO in New Orleans, Lane Kaplan-Levinson brings us this story.
Can I help you?
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Marilyn Miller, and I'm here with Lane Kaplan-Levinson. We're interested in being admitted to the facilities to do a story on the enemy alien internment camp here in the 1940s.
All right, hold on a second, please.
Thank you.
This is about the time when the guy over the loudspeaker at the U.S. Border Patrol office in Algiers is going, what the?
Ma'am?
Yes, sir.
I was told to let you know that our media person is not here today. You would have to call and set up an appointment and just ask for Agent Rivette.
Okay, calling Agent Rivette, operations officer for the U.S. Border Patrol office in Algiers.
The facility currently functions as a headquarters component for the New Orleans Sector Border Patrol.
The entire Gulf Coast arm of the U.S. Border Patrol is managed out of that site.
The day you and Marilyn showed up, I was actually out of the office.
Marilyn is Marilyn Miller, an associate professor of Caribbean and Latin American Studies at Tulane University. She and I went over there because we were actually more interested in how this U.S. Border Patrol facility, right on the river in Algiers, was used during World War II, when it was Camp Algiers.
As far as some sort of camp, I've never heard of that story.
Not many people have. When you think of World War II internment camps, you think of Japanese Americans detained after Pearl Harbor. The Camp Algiers story is part of a much smaller government internment program, but one often overlooked. Not by Marilyn Miller, who's studying the history of this Border Patrol Center on the river.
All of these buildings would have been part of a facility which was used in the 1940s to house enemy aliens who arrived to New Orleans from countries from Latin America.
Let's start on December 7th, 1941.
A date which will live in infamy.
Pearl Harbor. The FDR administration becomes increasingly concerned that in addition to Western Europe and Japan, there might be a third Axis front, Latin America.
Where more than 1.5 million Germans lived. Some of them might be Nazi agitators, even saboteurs and spies, who could conceivably rise up and overthrow governments and open up another front.
This is Max Paul Friedman, a history professor at American University and an expert on the Latin American deportation operation during World War II.
The Roosevelt administration, they asked FBI agents to go and find the dangerous Nazis in Latin America. But they weren't sending the best people because the best people were busy where the war really was or in security at home. So they sent people without Spanish or German or a lot of talent. And what they did in most countries was, you know, what you would imagine, open their wallets and offer to pay for information for anybody who would denounce a Nazi. And that created a system that was riven with corruption, where some of the Latin American dictators would say, oh, you want Nazis? This guy who owns a farm next to my farm, he's a Nazi. And they would deport some of their own residents in order to seize their property.
It sounds crazy. The U.S. government sending D-string FBI agents to find Nazis in Latin America, kidnap them, and bring them to America? But it's true. Just days after Pearl Harbor, thousands of Europeans who had moved to Latin America were rounded up and eventually deported to New Orleans. Here's Marilyn again.
When they came to the United States then, they were stripped of their documents, as they were stripped of their clothing. So they were treated in a way as if they were, in fact, prisoners, even though they had done nothing.
The secretive program called the Enemy Alien Control Program was run by the State Department and was in many ways illegal. It was against the law at that time for the U.S. to seize individuals outside the U.S. So the State Department decided they would get around this by refusing to issue entry visas for the Latin American deportees. When the Latin American residents arrived to the Port of New Orleans without papers, they were denied visas. Then they were arrested on the grounds that they had attempted to enter the country illegally and were therefore subject to internment.
My name is Nancy Carolina Cortez Reinbold.
I Skyped with Nancy from Honduras. When she was researching her family history, she came across these camps.
So my grandfather came up to this list. Mr. Fritz Reinbold.
Fritz Reinbold. Nancy's grandpa Fritz was born in Germany, but left before the war to live in Honduras, where he met and married Nancy's grandma.
He said that it was probably because he was rich. That was his only mistake.
Fritz was a clerk at the German embassy. He's one example of someone who was framed as a Nazi so that he would be forced to give up his property and assets to the Honduran government. He and his family were put on a ship to New Orleans in 1943. Nancy's mother was 11 months old.
I don't know how many days or weeks they spent there, but New Orleans was the point of delivery.
Every Latin American internee first arrived in New Orleans and was then shipped off to one of the other camps. Nancy's family was put on a train to Crystal City in Texas.
My grandfather never in his life talked about this. This is unforgivable. I cannot imagine how they felt. They took away everything.
Nancy knew her mom spent her first few years of her life in Texas, but never knew why. She discovered her family's experience on the German-American Internee Coalition website and saw that they were amongst 5,000 Europeans with a similar story. Not only were many of these people who were rounded up between 1941 and 1943 innocent, some of them were the actual victims of the war.
Approximately 81 Jews in various countries were rounded up.
This is Harvey Strum, a faculty member at the Sage College of Albany. I didn't think I could have possibly heard right when I was talking to Harvey. In search for Nazis, the United States deported and interned Jews?
Correct.
The great irony is that many of these quote-unquote enemy aliens, some small percentage of them were European Jews who had gone to Latin America when they were denied a visa to enter the United States for refuge. At least five of them had already been in concentration camps in Europe.
So you amazingly managed to escape from a concentration camp, try to enter the United States, are denied entry, so you go to Latin America instead, and are then kidnapped and sent to the U.S., only to once again live behind barbed wire.
And in some cases, they faced harassment and even beatings at the hands of real Nazis in the camps.
Because of the faulty accusations of so many deportees, a majority had no affiliation with the party. But there were still a good number of Nazi sympathizers who were also sent to those same camps. And Marilyn says they were pretty much allowed to do whatever they wanted.
Because the United States wanted to protect the health and welfare of their own prisoners of war in Europe, they were very careful to provide good treatment to German prisoners of war here. And so they were allowed to fly the swastika flag, or they were allowed to sing, you know, Nazi songs.
Which led to severe discrimination and beatings of Jews. The Jewish detainees in various camps across Oklahoma, Texas, Georgia demanded they have their own camp, a safe space where they wouldn't need to share a bunk bed with a Nazi, literally. There was additional pressure on the camps to do something because the National Refugee Service and various Jewish organizations got wind of what was happening and supported the demand that the Jews be moved. It also helped that camp administrators were starting to see the absurdity of the situation. Here's Max.
Camp commanders started writing to Washington saying, I thought we were going to be housing and guarding dangerous Nazis, and you're sending us whole families and old men and Spanish speakers and children, and we don't understand.
So what did the government do with these now-immigrant non-Nazis that accidentally got swept up with sympathizers? This is where Camp Algiers comes in, what's now the U.S. Border Patrol facility on the West Bank. Marilyn Miller explains.
When there were problems in other camps elsewhere in the United States, we have news stories from the Jewish Telegraphic Service that says Nazis and Jews fight in Camp X. And as a result of that, many times the Jews were sent to the Algiers facility as a refuge from this fighting. So New Orleans became known as the Camp of the Innocents.
So who were some of these Jews that had been deported from Latin America and then wound up in Camp Algiers? Max gives us some examples.
Werner Kappel, who was a 19-year-old German-Jewish refugee, who along with his father had been able to escape to Panama. They were picked up there by FBI agents because of reports that they'd been heard speaking German and therefore must be dangerous Nazis.
Werner and his dad were not Nazis, and neither was Otto Kugler, a dentist who left Germany for Honduras in 1930. When he was picked up and deported in the 1940s, all they told him was that he had spread Nazi propaganda. Kugler hadn't even seen any Nazi propaganda until he was thrown into a camp in Oklahoma with guys who said things like,
"Listen up, kid. In this camp, we're all Nazis, and anyone who doesn't agree will break his skull." And he watched on April 20th, which is Hitler's birthday, as some of the deportees would parade around singing Nazi songs and giving the Hitler salute.
So people like Werner and Otto were eventually removed from camps where things like that were happening to Camp Algiers, a Nazi-free camp. Marilyn Miller says internees in New Orleans had things to occupy themselves with inside the camp, and they were also allowed to leave for certain things.
They had access to some musical instruments. The residents of the camp were allowed to shop nearby, and they could even participate in Mardi Gras.
They'd be ferried over to the department stores of Canal Street, or they'd be sent over there for a parade. Equally important to Carnival, believe it or not, the kids of internees were also still allowed to learn.
Children who lived here were permitted to go to schools in Algiers, elementary school and high school.
One of the internees was even valedictorian of his high school. So imagine giving your speech at graduation and then returning home to fall asleep in your bunk bed behind bars. So internees like the valedictorian could leave, and they could have visitors. Here's Harvey Strum, a professor at Sage College in Albany.
It was members of the Jewish community who would come to the camps to offer services to the Jewish internees. For example, a representative of the Jewish Refugee Service in New Orleans, David Fichtman, came on a regular basis, sometimes three times a week. A rabbi from New Orleans came and held Jewish religious services at the camp.
It was the Jewish Refugee Service that first lobbied, along with the Jewish internees themselves, to get them to Algiers, away from the Nazis and other camps. And once they got to Algiers, it was the Jewish Refugee Service that worked to get them out. By now, it's 1943, and innocent people have been interned for almost 2 years. The Jewish Refugee Service contacts the National Refugee Service and says, "Look, we've got dozens of Jews locked up in New Orleans, and we've got to get them out."
Well, basically, the decision has been made in the spring of 1943 to possibly consider them for parolee at large.
Here's what happened. Jewish families in New Orleans and a bunch of other cities agreed to sponsor a Jewish refugee and take them in until further notice. They were essentially on parole.
The Jews at Algiers, most are released on parole to places, again, like Detroit, St. Louis, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, with the assumption that once the war ends, they go back to Panama or Honduras or go back to Germany, for that matter.
This is like a stopgap solution. They can leave the camps, but they can't go home and are basically on watch by an American foster family. And they need to report regularly to an immigration officer who's like a parole officer. Then the war ends. The camp gets decommissioned. But then no one really knows what happens next or what to do with all these people. Here's Max Paul Friedman.
The reason they couldn't be released initially is that U.S. officials couldn't agree that it would be okay to release them. They didn't want to send them back to their homes in Latin America. because they had put a great deal of pressure on Latin American governments to expel them in the first place, like telling the Costa Ricans, if you don't hand over these Germans, we'll stop buying coffee and sugar.
Max says returning those people after that behavior, saying, oh, actually, these people are not dangerous, just kidding, would have undermined U.S. credibility. And there was another problem.
They didn't want to release them into the United States itself because they had entered illegally.
Which, remember, wasn't their fault, considering they were essentially kidnapped.
You have to understand that there was no legal basis for essentially kidnapping people living in other countries, bringing them to the United States, and locking them up. There's no law that allows for that. In fact, there are laws that forbid it.
Of the roughly 5,000 internees, less than 1,000 of them stayed in the U.S. after the war. Most of them wanted to return to Latin America and were ultimately able to.
Where they typically found that their property was gone and they had to start from scratch and sometimes to start a legal process to try to recover some of what they've lost.
In his article on this subject, Harvey Strum wrote, only Franz Kafka could have created a tale of German Jews being arrested as pro-Nazi enemy aliens and then being sent to the United States for internment with real Nazi sympathizers. But he says this bizarre and failed operation was a preview for more recent missteps that, according to him, our country shouldn't be proud of. Max Paul Friedman says there are some relevant questions that come out of this story that we as a nation need to ask ourselves.
What is the balance between civil liberties and national security? And does it require violating the former in order to ensure the latter? And this story seems to suggest that, at least in the case that I've studied very closely, it would have been much more effective for us to look for guilt in terms of individual acts rather than in group belonging or group identity. And that's a lesson that's important for our own time.
Thanks to reporter Lane Kaplan-Levinson. A longer version of this story first aired on Tripod, New Orleans at 300, which is a podcast about New Orleans history. It's produced out of NPR member station WWNO. Coming up on Latino USA, grappling with the health insurance system when you are a health insurance agent yourself.
Clearly, Mentor's situation wasn't that serious because, you know, no hospital would send someone to another hospital across town if her life were at risk.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Hi, this is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. This month marks Fresh Air's 30th anniversary as a daily NPR interview program. That means our show is older than two of the people who work on it. So, how are we celebrating? By doing more shows. You can find our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Tantas maneiras, não há certeza, a decisão vai se justificar. Não vale a pena perder a beira, deselegante é se precipitar, mas é tão legal.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, celebrating 25 years of showcasing what works in K-12 education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at LumberLiquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Fernanda Echavarri in for Maria Hinojosa.
For most of my childhood, my father was self-employed and, like a lot of entrepreneurs, did without health insurance.
This is Michael Lujan, and when he was a kid growing up in L.A., he knew nothing about health insurance.
So as a kid, you know, when you did boy stuff and banged your head or split your head open and hopefully didn't need stitches, you didn't get them. So going to the doctor or the emergency room was reserved for really serious stuff.
Today, however, Michael knows quite a bit more about the complicated world of healthcare. He founded a startup that's trying to make signing up for health insurance more efficient. But even after years of working in the industry, he didn't really understand the intricacies of the healthcare system. He would only understand the scope and depth of it after someone very close to him ran into the system's problems head on.
I don't know too many people that got into health insurance on purpose. I got into health insurance by accident, went to my college career center, took an aptitude test. They sent me on 5 job interviews. The first one hired me, and it happened to be in insurance. So I started working in 1985 for a large company that processed claims for large employer groups. So a typical day processing insurance claims would be you get a stack of claims that are mailed in to the administrator, maybe 200 medical claims, most of which are going to be for ordinary things like urinary tract infections and an ankle sprain or something like that. But an occasional hospital bill, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. Every client had a threshold that said any claims over this amount should be researched to find out if they were pre-existing. What that meant was if we got a large claim, you would request medical records on the policyholder and research to find if there was any incidence of pre-existing conditions, lesions, respiratory ailments, anything that might be directly or indirectly a pre-existing condition. So I worked in claims for a couple of years until I realized the grind of X32. X32 was the code that we used for denying a claim for pre-existing conditions. That's not industry-wide. It was, you know, a code that we used internally. But that was etched in my mind. I'm on the ugliest side of health insurance, and I'd much rather be on the side of helping people get covered, not turn their claims down. So as quickly as I could, I got licensed in 1988 and became a licensed insurance agent. My mother was working as a caregiver for a large home health agency. You had benefits if you maintained a certain level of hours. And at some point, she fell below those hours and lapsed her coverage. So I found out in the emergency room, my own mother was uninsured. She had a car accident. So we are brought in via ambulance, 911, bring her into a private hospital in Sherman Oaks in the San Fernando Valley, suburb of Los Angeles. And I find out immediately that they can't admit her. They can stabilize her, but they won't admit her. She's barely breathing. She's been resuscitated, and it's a really serious situation. She suffered what's called a subdural hematoma, internal bleeding between the skull and the membrane that protects the brain. You know, my heart broke in that moment. You think about the 101 ways that you could work around the system. Could I just present my own ID card? Because I'm covered, because I'm covered through my employer. Is there some way that I can get her treated and I'll deal with the consequences later? All of these things race through your mind. I mean, it's your mother. But instead, I trusted the system. I trusted that they would do the right thing. They knew what they were doing, that the situation wasn't as serious as it seemed, and that whatever they were going to do, if transferring her to another hospital was what they were going to do, that clearly meant her situation wasn't that serious, because, you know, no hospital would send someone to another hospital across town if her life were at risk. From the private hospital, after what was about 2 hours delay, and keep in mind, the bleeding in her brain is causing compression on her brain, losing oxygen. Minutes are precious, and we've already been there for nearly 2 hours. We find out from the hospital admissions desk that they were going to put her in yet another ambulance and take her across town to LA County, USC. Me and my father are in my car racing behind an ambulance, literal ambulance chasers. But we're chasing this ambulance to East LA with my mother to, you know, get things fixed and hopefully take her home. We get to LA County, USC, and find out that this is the most concentrated, most intense, most I'd never seen and couldn't imagine any place like it, not in the U.S. It was a lot like a battle zone. County USC is a safety net hospital. It serves as the place of last resort, the health care for those who don't have any other resource. And right next to my mother is someone who was involved in a shooting on a gurney nearby. I think someone else. It's the most shocking trauma you'd ever seen. The worst car accidents, the most critical cases come through that small area. That's where I learned that her situation was, in fact, very dire. In fact, the emergency room physician slowed down enough, and this is when I knew it was serious, with all that chaos happening, slowed down enough to take me aside and tell me that I should say goodbye, that she would probably not make it through the night. That night, we said our goodbyes, and she went through 6 hours of brain surgery to relieve the pressure that has now been mounted for several hours. By that time, our family had all gotten together and we're all huddled in this crowded emergency room all night to find out that she did survive the surgery, but she was also vegetative. For the next 18 months, I quit my job immediately and became her full-time caregiver. One day, just sort of magically, she woke up. And by that, I mean, I don't mean as though nothing had happened, but I mean, could move her finger, could open her eyes, could attempt to speak, but couldn't yet. She never walked again. She was bedbound for the rest of her life. She died at 59 years old as a result of both her pre-existing liver condition and the head injury that effectively made her not a candidate for liver transplant. For a number of years, and for maybe obvious reasons, it's embarrassing for me to be a health insurance professional who has this story. There's nothing more helpless than to be someone who provides answers for other people but couldn't help his own mother. I think a lot of people are pondering the question, is healthcare a right or a privilege? And as simple as that question seems, the answers, I think, are very different depending on who you talk to. You know, we're a country that takes great pride in a lot of our personal freedoms, self-accountability. But in this one area, I think we're facing the sobering reality that our system may not be working. It may truly be broken.
That was Michael Lujan, co-founder of Limelight Health. Just like Lujan never expected to be on the other side of the health insurance industry, the residents of City of God, a favela in Brazil, didn't expect to have their neighborhood become known around the world. The film City of God has become a Latin American cult classic. It introduced the whole world to the sounds and sights of favela life, from the incredible music to intense violence. Journalist Jessica Diaz Hurtado spent time in today's City of God to see how much, if any, has changed since the movie's release in 2002.
It's been almost 15 years since the movie City of God debuted all over the world. And since the crew packed up and left, not much has changed in this neighborhood. Actor Leandro Firmino Daora remembers the incentive that got him out of the house the day that the studio arrived. Which is, in short, girls. Leandro says that without any formal acting training, he never thought of acting as a career choice. He wanted to go into the Navy. But what convinced him to go to the audition for City of God wasn't the chance to become famous. It was the girls that were there hanging out at the auditions. You may recognize his character in the movie.
Hey, quem falou que a boca é tua, cara?
Meu nome agora é Zé Pequeno.
It's the infamous introduction to the character Zé Pequeno, played by Firmino. Rocket, the main character, narrates that Zé Pequeno always wanted to be the boss of City of God, o dono da favela. And it's true. The movie is based on the real-life Zé Pequeno. And playing this character wasn't easy. Firmino knows the struggle of being an actor in Brazil, and a black actor at that.
Ela não representa, de alguma forma, a maior parcela da população.
He says that if you look at TV, black Brazilians are not represented. And that's what makes City of God unique. It was one of the first feature films from Brazil that employed almost all black actors born and raised in the comunidades, in the favelas. Most of them weren't trained in acting. Life trained them to survive.
A comunidade, ela continua coexistindo.
That's Sergio Leal, also known as DR. He was born and raised and still lives in City of God. Not only is he a community leader and pioneer in Rio's hip-hop movement, he was one of the researchers behind the film. He says that this community continues to coexist, to survive. If we're looking on a map, City of God geographically is on the western side of Rio, which is a hard part of the city to get to. And it's also not your normal favela that lives up in the hills. It's flat, and it's a cross between urban and rural. It takes about 2 hours on a bus, and that's honestly one of the only ways to get there and back. Although the center of the neighborhood is developed with businesses along the main road, there are still dirt streets. There are kids who walk with no shoes. And at train stations, it's not rare to see black folks up on a wall while police officers harass them. This is in a country where 50% of the population identifies as black. And in City of God, their Afro-descendant roots run deep. But so does their police's accusations of racism. This past November, police were accused of killing 7 people in City of God. This woman explains how she found her husband. She says there were 2 shots to his neck and that they ripped his leg off. Understanding City of God is understanding the racial implications in Brazil. Last year, I talked to Tehi about this. He says one afternoon, he was walking home, and he received a message that a boy was killed on his street. He says the system killed him. Who is guilty in this story? Who is innocent in this story? Death and displacement constantly lurks behind the city's poor. City of God is a result of the Plano de Remoção, or removal plan. Here's how City of God was born. Political repression during the dictatorship ended up kicking people out from their own homes in the favelas close to Copacabana and Ipanema. So housing projects were created, and the people who were displaced from their homes were relocated to communities marginalized from the center of the city, hence City of God.
E aí, assim, a partir do momento que as pessoas vieram morar aqui na Cidade de Deus,
Tehi says that City of God didn't have the infrastructure to support all the people there. So there was 40 to 50 families sharing one community bathroom. And he says that the tensions didn't begin with crime. It began with residents who came from different cultural backgrounds. Just last year, City of God, the neighborhood, turned 50 years old, half a century. And even though the movie depicts lots of the real violence that still lives on, there's still a beauty in the struggle.
Eu só quero é ser feliz, andar tranquilamente na favela onde eu nasci.
If you didn't know, City of God was a pioneer in carioca funky music. It's a genre inspired by American funk and hip-hop.
DJ!
You hear that? That's one of the most recognizable old-school funk songs, called Happy da Felicidade, or Rap of Happiness. It's by Siginho e Doca, 2 City of God natives. They used to perform at the neighborhood samba school, Mocidade Unida da Cidade de Deus. It's an aging blue and white large four-story building with a large venue on the first floor and even a small Muay Thai gym on the fourth floor. It overlooks the center of the favela. Last summer, City of God's own Rafaela Silva won an Olympic gold medal in judo. On the other side of this neighborhood, when the street pavement meets the dirt, there's a free youth Muay Thai, judo, and jiu-jitsu open gym. Children as young as 4 years old gear up and learn the martial art. Deahi's daughter is one of the students. She covers her face when she starts to fight, but the instructor, a local professional Muay Thai fighter, tells her to open her eyes, that she needs to face her opponent and take the hits. This is how City of God builds confidence and builds strength in their people.
Thanks to reporter Jessica Diaz Hurtado for that story. And that's it for today. Latino USA is produced by myself, Fernanda Echavarri, Marlon Bishop, Antonia Cerejido, Jeannie Montalvo, Julia Hsu, Zakia Gibbons, and Noam Hassenfeld. Our senior editor is Nadia Raymond. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fiedelholz. Our interns are Nicola Acevedo, Caterin Gonzalez, and Manolo Morales. If you enjoy the music you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlists. I'm Fernanda Echavarri, filling in for our host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. The Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at heisingsimons.org. And Carnegie Corporation, promoting the advancement of knowledge and understanding.
You don't know Despacito. 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 Pasito a pasito. Suave, suavecito. Like that. What am I saying again?
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org. And Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. This is NPR.
Next time on Latino USA, we're going Greek.
Hey guys, I seen y'all campus around. I was wondering if y'all were interested in learning a little bit about my fraternity. It's a Latino-based fraternity.
We learn about the oldest Latino fraternity. That's next time on Latino USA.